Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Hybrid Jazz is a vision of all that is jazz, both traditional and contemporary, domestic and global. Here's your host, Trish Hennessy.
Well, thank you, Dave. Woo! Yeah, it's Friday. How about that? Not the Thursday, the usual time that we do Hybrid Jazz. And if you were paying attention on Tuesday and you know that and you're sitting in with us today, thank you so much. We are just about at 105,000 listens. That is just too awesome for words. Which leads me to telling you about today's show. Woo! Let me just say this. Washington Women in Jazz, Ellen Seeling, and then Arnold Strickland. So we're going to have, hopefully, Amy K. Borman in the first hour with WWIJ, and then Ellen in the second half of the hour, then music next hour, and then Arnold in the third. It should be an interesting mix. We're going to go from slightly moderate to severe to wonderfully radical feminism, and then we're going to get to Arnold Strickland and hear Invasion of the Booty Snatchers in the third hour. Yay! I'm telling you, it's hybrid, baby. So I figured what we're going to do, since Amy will be calling in momentarily, is give you a little taste of something that she did a few years ago from Striking, her CD. This is Girly Samba of Death and Destruction. Amy K. Borman on Hybrid Jazz. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, she plays the piano with a vengeance. She composes. She arranges. She's a vocalist. She is a born leader. She is responsible for the Washington Women in Jazz Festival, and she has a lovely last name that, when you look at it, you're dying to say Gourmet, like the late Edie Gourmet. But no, she is Amy K. Bormitt, ladies and gentlemen, and we welcome her to Hybrid Jazz. Hey, Amy!
Hey, Trish, what's happening? Thanks for that beautiful introduction.
Absolutely. Oh, you're such a beautiful spirit. My God, it's been ages since I talked to you. What is shaken besides the obvious?
Oh, man, you know, just being a mad woman. Well, you know, I'm doing this festival, and I moved to Los Angeles in September because my husband's going to graduate school at USC.
Wow.
It's been totally insane, and I just flew into D.C. last night, and of course, you know, good old United, all my flights were delayed, so I got in after midnight, and I was still overexcited just coming into town. I was telling everyone on the plane about the festival. I think they hated me, and I had them all in a tiny space, and I was like, hey, guys, you guys going to D.C.? You want to come to my show?
Oh, my God. And you know what? You are tired and wired right now, aren't you?
It's cool. I got the green tea chill, you know? It's nice. The caffeine, it's the relaxation.
So seriously, everything was delayed?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't understand. I flew through Houston. I don't even know how there'd be snow, but, you know.
Wow.
I didn't even have a plane at one point. I was like, you guys need to get a plane here because I have things to do. So.
And I'm just going to jump in because this Washington Women in Jazz Festival has developed a life of its own. And this is such strong buzz. And thanks to our friend Janice for interceding in so much in regard to women in jazz, because this hour is going to be action-packed. We'll have Ellen Sealing coming up in the next half hour or so. But
yes.
How important is this, Amy? I mean, it's getting to be monumental now because women really – I didn't think 30 years ago, because I'm way older than you, I didn't think that we were going to have the need to separate women and jazz, but we desperately need to still, don't we?
Yeah, there's just – you know, I'm just trying really hard to create this space for women to perform and to strut their stuff and do their thing, mostly because I struggled with it and I've seen – people that I've grown up with struggle with it, and I don't understand, and I'm getting more and more frustrated. So that's kind of where this festival was born, out of sort of just a frustration seeing people not be able to book these major jazz festivals, and to see these major jazz festivals have maybe one, you know, female instrumentalist, maybe, if you're lucky,
yeah,
you know, as a headliner. And then to see, you know, locally, the DC Jazz Festival, you know, they do nothing for women. There's very limited women on their programming, their DC Jazz, you know, Jazz on the Hoods. They have very few female instrumentalists. So I just wanted to make sure that people knew that we were there and that we were allowed and that we were really good. So
yeah, and gosh knows, past couple of years, you have opened some eyes, because I have heard males say to me, either via email or actually on the phone or text messages or whatever, saying, holy cow, I had no idea. And that's usually the response, because, you know, when you have women like this who come together who are so great artistically, sometimes these guys have no clue that you're even existing.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, I think one of my favorite moments was last year. We did a pre-show jam session, and Jen Krupa, who's a great trombone player for the Navy Commodores, she was out playing, just burning down the house, and I was sitting next to Chris Funn, who's, you know, an amazing bass player and just a wonderful guy, and he turns and looks at me, and he's like, how come I've never heard of this woman before? Like, how come I've never seen her before? Like, what's what's going on? He's like, I need to call my dad. I need to tell everybody about just what I've seen. And I feel like that's the kind of stuff, you know, that's the vibe I'm going for. And everyone in D.C. has been so supportive, and especially the jazz community has just eaten this up. I mean, they're so excited, and I've just gotten so much excitement, you know, and I've had plenty of men that have come to me and are volunteering and helping out and spreading the word and, you know, handing out postcards and trying to figure out how they can help and how they can get in. So it's beautiful.
That's so wonderful. And I got to say, since the last time you were here, I'm now on the board of directors of the Baltimore Jazz Alliance. So they're going to get hit with this full throttle. They already know some of this, but you know, D.C. and Baltimore need to go hand in hand, and we need to be helping one city out for the other, because we're sister cities, and there's so much wonderful jazz, and we've all, you know, come to know the male artists, but we really do need to know names of female artists who play jazz. And one of the things that you do, Amy, and I just love it, you shine the light on young female jazz talent. How do you find them? Tell us.
Well, a lot of it is word of mouth. I spent the last 7 years I've been teaching at the Washington Jazz Arts Institute with Davey Yarbrough. And I just absolutely adore Davey Yarbrough. And I went to Duke Ellington and studied with him. And he's just been a lifelong mentor and just friend, and I just love him and all of his teaching style, and everything is so open, and he really makes it easy for women to feel like they have a place. You know, I even though there was only a few women that were in the jazz band when I was in high school, we always, you know, felt like we were part of the team. I had to carry a bass drum down the stairs and heels. Like, it was always like, you know, this is what you asked for. I'm gonna hold you to it. So he's been cultivating women, you know, female jazz musicians since, you know, Janelle Gill came out of Duke Ellington, Jessica Boykin Settles, very strong role models for me growing up. Those, you know, those were the women that I looked at and I said, well, I want to be like this. You know, these women are incredible, and they're working and they're teaching and they're really spreading knowledge. They're big jazz evangelists, you know? So,
yeah.
He has had some amazing women that I have taught that have been in that program. So that was kind of my base, and I went from there. You know, Paul Carr, I hit him up and told him about the Young Artist Contest that I have, and I have a wonderful couple of interns this year from Howard University, and they made me a list of all of the schools and all of the, you know, all of the private schools, all the colleges, anywhere there was a jazz program, and the contact information. So I just kind of threw all that information at everybody so that nobody could act like they didn't know about it.
That's great. And you've
but
got a forum.
I mean, definitely.
These young women are going to be playing, and that's so exciting because, you know, it's not even like, to me, a competition. It's like the absolute joy of being able to be on a stage with one another and not have the fear of being looked at in a certain way because you're a chick on stage.
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, I have a female backing band, and I have, you know, my trio there, and we play for all of the, you know, all of the students, and they all have a chance to rehearse, and then we have a big jam session at the end, so they all play together. So it's great. I mean, it's really just a showcase and to encourage these women to really meet other, you know, young female jazz musicians and have some, you know, have some gigs with them, have some connections to women their age, because a lot of times they're the only one in their school, you know, who's a girl and who's playing. You know, it's like, oh, it's just me and my lonely saxophone chair, you know, and we're losing a lot of women from when they get out of college and they want to be professional musicians because they don't have the network of support that men have. You know, they don't have that sort of, you know, male nepotism where you can go and hang out at the gig late at night. Like, they don't have that. Single women don't have that coming out of college, coming out of high school. It's a lot more difficult to just make the hang as a single woman. So I'm trying to make that transition easier so that we don't lose incredible musicians who are in their early 20s.
Yeah, and the word that's been bandied about, especially in researching Ellen Sealing and what she is doing at this big rally. Oh, if you haven't heard about this rally, Amy, she's going for the jugular, baby. She's going.
No joke.
Oh, my God. The big word is cronyism. We don't have the luxury of cronyism. We can't go to the clubs and hang out because we're either harassed or we're in the famous words of a musician whose name is going to come up in the next half hour, we're a distraction. So,
how did you know?
Yeah. So I have put the Washington Women in Jazz poster as my timeline photo, and it's March the 15th through the 22nd. You want to tell us, you are looking for help in this regard. Please tell us how we can help you make sure this is a smooth transition when it comes about.
Definitely. Well, I did all my budget, and this is the fourth year I've done the festival, and I just keep adding more things, which is great, but, you know, then I got to ask for more help. I got to get more people involved, and I'm really trying hard to make everyone, who is involved with the festival happy, and I need to, buy them food, and I need to get them places, and there's all these added expenses when you add events. So the events themselves, I've pretty much taken care of the funding before, but all of the auxiliaries and my wonderful interns and my wonderful volunteers and my T-shirts and my postcards and all that stuff, I'm just, reaching out and asking this awesome jazz community, the DC jazz community, and now, Ellen Sealing has been giving me, giving the festival funds, and people from all over the place have been donating to this festival. So we have a two-week campaign that's part of the Fractured Atlas fiscal sponsorship, so you can actually get tax deductions, and
right.
Anyone who'd like to donate can go to our website. It's WashingtonWomenInJazz.com, and we have it's an Indiegogo campaign, but it's not like a lot of other campaigns where they say donate and they don't mean tax deductions. I mean tax deductions. You can get a tax write-off for giving your money to the Women in Jazz Festival, so there's no excuse.
Yep. Hey, listen, everybody who's listening live or who will be listening in the archives, this woman has busted her tiny hiney to make sure that this has come to fruition, and now she's in freaking L.A., so she's doing legwork in California, paving the way for folks, women folk in Washington. So, I mean, you have really done a lot to raise the consciousness, and you talk about a wonderfully radical year for us to support Washington Women in Jazz. I think, Amy,
mm-hmm.
this is the year. This is the year.
I hope so. I'm feeling great. I'm feeling just wonderful. So,
are you?
I think it's going to be incredible. And, I've got a bunch of I'll be all over town in D.C. this weekend, so if you're listening from D.C., you'll see me. I'll have my WWJF T-shirt on, and I will come straight up to you and give you a postcard and tell you all about how you can support us. I'm not scared.
She will. She will. I'm telling you. I'm just warning you ahead of time. She will come up to you, and she will be relentless, because that's the operative word for women in jazz right now. We are relentless.
Well, That's the only way we're going to get attention is being, loud or proud. So we do what we need to do.
You are exactly right. And thrill us with some of the names that are going to be involved in the festival this year, because you've got some great women.
I do. I have. It's insane. And it's so great, because I have some people who've been on the festival before, and to see them grow and develop. I have somebody who started out as an intern for me, and now is, hitting it big time at the Betty Carter Jazz Ahead, Strathmore Artist in Residence, and now is putting out her EP the first night. I got the opening night of the festival is Integrity Reeves.
Woo-hoo!
Who also is a great, Duke Ellington School, Howard University, Peabody, you know, all the local hotspots. She's been studying that, and she's been working her way up, and I'm just so excited that, you know, the first year I did this, she came to me, and she was like, how can I help? What do you need me to do? You want me to hand out some stuff? What do you want? And I was like, you're the greatest. So I'm so excited that I can support her and her wonderful voice. Sunday day, I've got Jessica Blick and Tuttles doing a tribute to Shirley Horn at the Smithsonian Anacostia Community Museum at 2 o'clock.
Wow.
This is the third year she's done one of these big tributes. She did Abby Lincoln, she did Betty Carter, and now she's taking it all the way to D.C. and doing Shirley Horn. And this is going to be packed. I don't even want to tell people about it because they're not even doing it. It's going to be so crowded. So, I'm so excited.
Wow.
So
that is awesome. Oh, my God. A tribute to Shirley Horn. Oh, whoa. And that's so primo for D.C. because Shirley Horn was so beloved in Washington, D.C. You know, one of the favorite people that Miles Davis ever had in his life was Shirley Horn. And he was not alone. She did so much to enhance the role of women in jazz because not only was she one of the consummate vocalists, but she was completely at one with that piano.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Man.
So I'm really excited about this. And Jess is like, she's the queen of research. You know, she taught for 7 years for the jazz vocal department at Howard University. And she's not playing around. She goes to the Smithsonian and digs up stuff, and she goes to the Library of Congress and digs up stuff. She finds videos, you know, online, and she orders them. She told me she spent like $50-something just finding some random VHS on Amazon. I was like, what are you doing? So she's digging up stuff for this, and she does a presentation about the life of Shirley Horn. And then we're going to be doing a 45-minute set of Shirley Horn's music. So
awesome. Bless her heart. That is some work. Whoa, that's too cool.
She's not afraid. So, you know, and it's just every year it's been amazing to see her just break down someone's life and then show how their music reflected exactly what was going on. So,
wow.
It's wild.
And you have another name that actually, when you were here on the show with us last year, because we had another one of these exciting times, Effervescent, woohoo! You are featuring somebody then that you're featuring again this year, are you not?
Maybe. Lee
Jen?
I have Jen Krupa and Lee Pilzer on Thursday. Thursday the 20th, they're playing. This is yet again another free show. I don't want people complaining to me about how they can't afford tickets to my shows because I got free stuff, right? Don't be a bum.
But the T-shirts aren't, dagnabbit.
The T-shirts aren't free, but I got free shows. If you want a T-shirt to wear to the show, you got to give me $20. But, you know, if you want to just come to the show, you're welcome to.
That's right. You know what you say to people?
Jacked.
You say to them,
what?
Look, the show is free. Buy a dadgum T-shirt, for heaven's sake.
I mean, come on.
Come
really
on.
So much? Give me some money on my Indiegogo.
And look.
Lee's got this big hoopty. Yeah, go ahead.
No, how much time do you have for this Indiegogo situation, the campaign?
Much time? 5 more days.
5 more days.
So it's ticking away.
So are you almost there? Do we need to push this until we're relentlessly blue in the face?
You know, more the merrier. But and we're at $1,500, and we need $2,500.
Oh,
but
you'll get that.
We're not far at all.
We're not far at all.
And I feel like the money's going to come through, so I don't want you to be blue in the face. And I think people know. I don't think I need to guilt trip them into giving me money. I think they know. So I just want to reach out to people who don't know and say, you know, have you heard about the festival? And I think once they hear about it, people give money. You know, that's the encouraging thing that I've seen is that when I started the campaign, it was all people on the festival and their friends, you know, and my family members. And now I'm getting names, you know, people donating. I've never heard these people. And I said, that's definitely encouraging, you know, to see that people are interested and they're not just interested because they're, you know, they're trying to be nice to somebody on the festival. They're trying to be nice to me. You know, they're interested because they believe in the cause. So I think once people know about it, they happily give. So that's what I've been finding out.
Well, and first I have to say I don't mind being blue in the face at all because I love the movie Avatar. But that's a different story entirely. If we have five more days, we're going to get that handled. And you are right. If people know about it, because, look, we just are being bombarded with different information every day. And it's like we have all turned ADHD. We're all looking at the shiny, flashy thing in front of our faces.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many shiny, flashy things that we don't know how to focus. So if we just focus on a couple of these things, seriously, Amy, by the time this show is over today, you're going to have a whole new audience for people paying attention to you because this is all about this first couple of hours here, feminism, and we have to rethink it. We have to support one another. Women have to, because apparently in some ways we're on our own. So the more we can get together and get rid of the nonsense that has been pushed down our throats for years about, oh, women can't get along. That's BS, and that's a lie that men perpetuated. So we have to get it together enough to be able to say, forget everything that you ever learned or heard. Let's just do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's exceedingly difficult, as a musician, the intense competition between each other. You know, everybody wants to cut everybody down. And that's what I love about DC is that nobody wants to cut anybody down. That vibe doesn't exist in the sound. Everybody's out there for everybody else. And, the scene is so supportive. And growing up in this scene, this is the right place for me to be doing this because people, like I said, I've had people just turning up everywhere trying to give me help for this. So I'm so grateful that we don't have, infighting and all sorts of weird drama, and that our only cutting contests are actually on the bandstand,
That's great.
It's been good. Yeah, definitely. And I think for ADHD, I'm going to make a BuzzFeed quiz and say, which WWJF artist are you? And then see if I can get that to go on Facebook.
Oh,
wow.
Like,
I am Lee Tilzer. No, I'm kidding. I think they'd kill me if I made that.
Well, I love the idea that you have a separate page on Facebook. I mean, not only the very cool website that is completely up to date, God bless you, but you also have the Facebook page, and you have a Twitter page, a Twitter name, right?
Yeah, we have a Twitter. It's at WWJazzFest. So,
okay.
And one of my interns named me a Tumblr page, but I think it's mostly just. It's mostly just photos. I have people, anything that you take a picture on Instagram and tag it as WWJF, it shows up on this Tumblr account. So that's kind of cool. So if anybody's into Tumblr and they're not 13 years old, then they're into it. That's probably the crowd, right?
You know what? Don't be shy about telling these folks. This is the beauty of Twitter, because if you let certain people know, like if you target certain people like Esperanza Spalding or like Gretchen Parlato or one of these high-profile jazz women, if you pinpoint them and say, hey, look, just so you know, this is coming up, Washington Women in Jazz, you're going to get immediate gratification, just like going to McDonald's. You're going to get somebody writing back to you and saying, I did not know. Tell me more. I promise you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I'll tell my intern. I have a Twitter intern, so I'll send that memo over. My large establishment, I'll get some letterhead out and send a memo.
That would be awesome. And here's what I want to say to you. I don't know how tired and or wired you are. If you want to, Amy, Ellen is on the line, and I want to make sure I get her involved in this conversation because now you and she have bonded. Is that correct?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Ah, I love this. Oh, my God. I'm so grateful for this hour. Well, look, you stay on the phone because we need to be talking about this. I know how Ellen is. Oh, I have known her for a short time, but in that time it's been glorious. This is a wonderful jazz trumpet instructor at UC Berkeley. She is an instructor at the Jazz School. She is the founder, director, and CEO of the Montclair Women's Big Band. This is the marvelous and certainly outspoken, oh, so grateful, Ellen Sealing. Ellen, how are you?
Hi, Trish. How are you?
I'm better now that you're on the line. I'm better.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Your wonderful voice is there. And Amy K. Bormitt is with us because we are going to hang on your every word.
Oh, please. No pressure.
No pressure now, yeah.
No, seriously, you are doing what few women have dared to do. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, well, thank you. But I have to say I think if anything comes out of this push recently, well, the most important thing that might come out of it is that women start to stick up for themselves. I'm so flabbergasted at how they run away from this issue, women musicians. They have everything to gain and really nothing to lose. What are people going to do, not hire them more? Make them more invisible? You know, I mean, really, we have nothing to lose. And I think, you know, women jazz players learn, instrumentalists particularly, but vocalists as well, they learn as they come up that they sort of have to go along to get along. And the women who really want to play and want to do it for a living and are serious about, you know, their skill and their art, they will really block stuff to get opportunities. And they sort of have to. It's a survival technique in jazz for women and has been forever. But the downside of that is that they really don't do anybody else any good. They might get along themselves. I've heard some tremendous women players say, well, I don't want to be bothered with all that political stuff. I just want to play it. And the best way to combat sexism in this music, if they'll even recognize that there is such a thing, is to be the best player I can be. Well, maybe, but it hasn't worked that good, has it?
Right, right.
You know? I mean, it hasn't worked that good in terms of moving sexism and jazz, you know, in dealing with it. It's maybe been good for individual players, and it's gratifying to see, you know, I'm 60, almost 64, so somebody in their 20s or 30s to me is a young player. It's great to see so many young women players coming up, but I still see there's such a glass ceiling, and Wynton Marsalis's Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra is a good example of that. And there's also in education, in high school education, girls are really invisible, and they're not interested a lot of times in their high school jazz bands because they just have to deal with so much stuff that it's not worth it to them. Somebody sent me, maybe it was you, I sent me a picture of this honors band somewhere in the country called America's Jazz Band, and it's, you know, 19 boys. And
yes.
I followed the thread on their own website, I mean their own Facebook page, and some concerned mothers, I guess, or people involved with this project, you know, once they put up a picture of the band and showing 19 or 20 boys and, you know, their male director, started saying, wow, no girls in this band. And the director immediately went to, okay, you women, I'm going to put you in charge of recruiting girls for next year. I don't pick them. I just rehearse them. And I just think that is such, you know, a bad attitude for an educator. Are we educating the boys, or are we educating all of our students? And if girls are having problems in high schools and middle school bands, why are we not dealing with that? Is it unimportant? You know, is it because they can't play? I mean, you know, it's utterly systemic.
And right there shows you an attitude of disrespect. And when young women feel that, I mean, already we feel as though we're second-class citizens, by and large.
And honestly, and Amy, you're much younger, but Ellen and I were having this discussion. Honest to God, you reach a certain age and you start to think, do you realize what I've been thinking all these years and how wrong that was to think that? Because I was told it for so long, and now I'm realizing what kind of crap that is. You know, we really do need to start way early. It's like this guy that you were just referencing threw his hands up, will you women take care of it? What kind of message does that send out?
Well, I mean, it's clear that what to me it's very clear. It's that this is an unimportant issue. It's not his fault. He's not going to deal with it. It's the girl's fault. Well, let's blame the victims. They're not interested. So, and I would like to actually reference a very interesting article written by Dr. Ariel Alexander, who I believe is an L.A. saxophonist and educator, who had a guest editorial in Jazz Ed magazine a couple years ago, called Where Are the Girls? And she goes through a number of reasons why girls are turned off to this music. And, you know, she claims that research tells us that girls and young women are shown to be much more successful when they have female role models. Well, that's number one. I mean, you can look at any college faculty, jazz department faculty, any major jazz festival in the country, any big club, any local club, any of the big bands, with the exception of the Smithsonian Band, who has added three women in the last couple of years, and I would like to give them a big old shout-out. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, their lead trombonist, I believe, currently, and their lead trumpet player are both women. Jen Krupa, I believe, is their lead bone player, and Lisa Whittaker is their lead trumpet player, and Lee Pilzer also plays in the band.
Yes.
I think currently. So, well, that's three out of, I don't know, 19 or 16 or something is a big step for women. You know, and the fact that girls can see women up on the stage, they're not going to identify with anybody going to see Wynton Marsalis's band. They're not going to relate to that in one little way, one little bit. And I got a chuckle out of, you know, Wynton doesn't have any women in his band because they're too distracting. I know where that came from. But I actually almost sort of met him myself when I played with Machito's band at the Village Gate in the early 80s. And I was the only woman in that band. And he was either visiting town or had just moved there or something, came down to see the band. And during the break, walked up to the trumpet section. And you know, I was playing second trumpet at the time and splitting some of the lead. And utterly ignored me and talked to the guys in the band. And, you know, I wasn't going to introduce myself to him. I didn't care, really. And but, you know, after playing in New York with all-male trumpet sections and big bands and salsa bands for 15 years, I just knew it was not going to be a happy conversation. So I sort of, you know, I sort of ignored him, too. But we definitely need role models. And, you know, the stereotyping of instruments for girls is also an issue. You know, boys play the trombone and the drums and the trumpet, and girls play the flute and stuff like that.
Oh, this could be another 3-hour discussion.
But this is serious. This is a serious problem in terms of trying to get girls interested in jazz, and big obstacles that may not be immediately aware. You know, people might not be aware of upon first glance.
Well, and here's the thing. I had not necessarily been familiar with the term blind auditions. And my first particular word association is The Voice. So when I saw Janice Rochelle Littlejohn mention you and did research on you, and then you added to the discussion the other day on Facebook, Ellen, it was really eye-opening because what you were saying made such perfect sense. Part of this rally on March 22nd in San Francisco to make sure your voice is heard and a large group of people's voice are being heard in regard to the all-man band at Lincoln Center, you want to see blind auditions, and that makes perfect sense. Why?
Well, I mean, let's be fair. You know, let's provide equal access for everyone. I mean, how he has been able to get away for 26 years with not holding auditions to such a prestigious institution and ensemble is really it's flabbergasting to me. How they managed to get around the EEOC's rules about against discrimination on any basis, you know, gender, race, whatever, I don't know. There's never been a woman member of that organization in 26 years since it was founded in 1988. Winton does not hold auditions. He does not announce openings of positions. And he basically just picks somebody. And you can do that if you're, you know, some local big band leader, community big band leader who, you know, wants to get together with his buddies and have some fun and drink beer on Sunday. But, you know, if you're running America's jazz band, really, you know, this band represents America all over the world. They have a tremendous educational outreach wing, which I've had a number of girl trumpet students go with their high schools to jazz at Lincoln Center and be involved in clinics and things with the orchestra. And they all come back and tell me, you know, there were no women there. I'm like the only girl in my band, or maybe there's one other. And nobody paid any attention to us. They ignored us the whole time. Nobody spoke to us. We felt isolated. We felt excluded. We didn't relate to anyone or anything. And, you know, to me, calling their jazz outreach educational is just not serious. They're not being serious about jazz education. If students, you know, even if they are girls, God forbid, go to something like this and feel that way when they finish. You know, when they get out of there, they don't feel uplifted. They don't feel educated. They don't feel accepted. They don't feel excited about jazz. They want to get out at that point.
Wow. Wow, Amy, you're really listening and you're pondering this, I know. And I have to say, as an aside, just so folks understand this, a typical band member at Lincoln Center sometimes makes what, Ellen, $100,000 could be?
That's what I understand. That is my understanding that, you know, some of my lawyer friends and I should say, did some, you know, a little bit of checking into where the money comes from and where it goes at Jazz at Lincoln Center. I believe Winton himself makes between $1.2 and $1.5 million a year. And I believe members of his orchestra make about $100,000 a year, which is about what major symphony orchestras pay, like the big ones, you know, like Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, pay their players. But that's big money in jazz. Big money in jazz. And so why are women excluded? Is it because because Winton thinks they can't play jazz? Or should women be excluded from making this kind of money just based, you know, on the basis of their gender? Should they not have an equal shot at a very prestigious gig, which could do wonders for one's career, not to mention the money? You know, I mean, back in the 70s, they were saying those same kinds of things about African-American players as regards symphony orchestras. And Dr. Art Davis, who sued the New York Philharmonic, who was an African-American bassist, a great jazz bass player, a great classical player, and couldn't get arrested over at the New York Philharmonic, sued the orchestra. And he was shunned by the other orchestra musicians and the other members of his community, African-American and white, for his activism. And women who speak out today against this sort of thing encounter that same kind of disrespect and anger, fury coming from the other side, you know, and it takes the form of personal attacks, name-calling, you know, you become a pariah in your own community. Even other women they don't want to rock the boat. They just want to play their gigs, and they, you know, want to do their art, and I don't blame them, but we sort of have to do something about this, you know.
Well, here's the thing, and this is one of the things that we have learned, Ellen, through the years, and we both of us have snapped out of it, thank God. But when you are, as an impressionable young woman, no matter whether you are white or black or yellow or red, whatever ethnicity you are, and you see in front of you, if you have any interest at all in jazz and want to pursue it because maybe you're playing trumpet or trombone, saxophone, whatever, and you really feel led to play instrumental music that is classified as jazz, and then you see what is lauded as America's jazz band that has all males in it, there's something in you, your spirit sinks because you think, I guess I don't belong to this club.
Well, yes. I mean, the message it sends to girls and to women, you know, the lack of role models, the lack of equal access, all of these things, it says to them that you're not good enough and nobody like you is good enough. That's why there aren't any in this orchestra. And you should, you know, go away somewhere and shut up. That's what it says to girls. That it would say the same thing to boys if the situation were reversed.
Of course.
Years ago, it would say the same thing to African Americans. I mean, these are all arguments, they're not good enough yet, that were used to keep African Americans out of baseball and out of you name it, and to keep women out of, you know, jobs like police work and firefighters and combat in the military, not to mention CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, not to mention the high-tech industry, which is really, and the world of science, which is a lot of times, you know, women get the message, girls get the message early on in school that they're not smart enough to do math, they're not smart enough to do science, and so they kind of give up on it, and they, you know, at that age, no, girls don't have a lot of confidence. Boys are sort of socialized to just kind of charge through things whether or not they're qualified. But girls are constantly second-guessing themselves. It's just their socialization, and it just is about the biggest cage that you could put someone in.
Oh, for sure, because you might have heard these messages growing up. I most certainly did. And, you know, I have spent most of my life now realizing that I was so uncomfortable with it because maybe you were told this too, Amy, but this is the message that was passed along not only from men who were maybe fathers or uncles or grandfathers, but also from our very own mothers who
Absolutely.
Said to us, just play along with them, honey. Make them think that they won. Don't rock the boat. Just be seen and
bad
not
advice.
Heard. Yes.
Bad advice.
Yes.
Well, you know, when I was coming up, I started playing when I was 12, which was in the seventh grade, and I never saw another girl or woman play trumpet until I went to Indiana University in 1969. And out of 100 trumpet players there, there were two other women. And so there were two when I went to college. And then when I went to New York after graduation in 75, the only other women trumpet players I saw working in town were Lori Frank, who got there about a year after I did, I think, and who is sort of legendary. People should know who she is. If they don't, you might want to Google her name, Lori Frank, who passed away last year. Really, really huge loss for women trumpet players at the age of 61. And there was one other player, and that was it for years and years and years when I was in New York. And then Rebecca Coop Franks moved to town, and some others kind of popped up, Pam Fleming and a few others. But and now there are a lot of them by comparison. But that the kind of message I got back then is that they're just – weren't any, and why are you so weird? Yeah. which question I have no answer. Except that my parents never told me that I couldn't do stuff. So living in rural Wisconsin, I loved hunting and shooting as a kid. I played baseball. I did all that stuff, only encouraged us. But when I got to college and when I got to New York and I started talking about, you know, I started getting work that guys thought they should get, then there was big problems.
You know, this is, I really didn't understand how much my heart was starting to speed up when this conversation was going to take hold, but, you know, so much gets bottled inside of you for so long, and, you know, Amy had just said, Ellen, that there were men who were really being generous with the Washington Women in Jazz Festival and men stepping up and wanting this whole scenario to be seen and heard because they were tired of women being shortchanged in regard to not getting asked to play, being overlooked, as you had mentioned, pretending that you weren't even there. It's just, it's 2014, and I'm almost not even in belief that we're having the conversation.
Oh, it's just so ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. I want to say one thing, though, that's been happening around the country, little by little, if I have enough time to say a couple of words yet.
Please.
Berkeley High in Berkeley, California, which has a world-class high school jazz program that has turned out many well-known pros. Recently, the director of the jazz department, the position was taken over by one of the trombonists in my band, Sarah Klein, and she has utterly changed the culture in that school in about 3 years. They now have 6 girls in the ensemble, whereas before there would be 1 or none, and that went on for 20 years, you know, since I moved here. And so she's having a Girls Jazz Day, which the high school is sponsoring, and it's free to all middle and high school girls from anywhere in the Bay Area who want to come, featuring an all-women pro faculty of about 15 or 20, you know, well-known Bay Area jazz women. And that, I believe, is being picked up by Jessica Jones and being sponsored by Jazz at Lincoln Center. To their credit, it's about time, but it's not going to substitute for putting women in the big band there. In addition to that, some other local band directors here, men, have instituted their own either Girls Jazz Day or reading sections for girls-only high school girls, putting together a big band of all the girls in the area to come and, you know, have a couple of days of reading through big band music. And I myself, with my partner Gene Feinberg, started what I believe is still the first and only camp of its kind, summer jazz camp of its kind, called Girls Jazz and Blues Camp, and we run it at the Jazz School in Berkeley. And it is for girls only from 6th grade through high school with an all-women's pro faculty. We started this in 2009. And it's gotten bigger and bigger every year. Last year we had almost 60 girls attend, and we had to close enrollment. And 2 years ago we started the same, a similar version for women, which this year we'll have about 40 women there. That will happen at the end of March. So these are things that if women want to get active and really affect change, you got to get to girls in elementary school and middle school. By the time they get to high school, it's kind of too late to talk them into being in their school jazz bands. So you got to get them really, really young, and we got to let them know that they can do it. And they need to see role models, and they need to have male band educators, jazz educators, step up and be proactive in encouraging and recruiting girls to participate.
That's right.
And
it's not only
the music, too. You know, this is good for jazz, too. I hear people whining all the time, jazz is dying. Well, it might. You know, if you keep excluding, it's like a Republican Party of American music. You can't exclude everybody and grow, you know. You can't do that.
Can't make that
work. Listen, you know what? I have someone who is, and I think that I recognize this area code, Do you both have a couple more minutes? Is it cool if I get somebody else on the line? Okay.
It's a party.
I have Charmaine Michel on the line, who is an extraordinary trumpeter, and she is also one of these high profile, certainly in our region, raising awareness of injustice. And she it has been in the chat room, and I know she's been chomping at the bit to say something. So, Charmaine, please enter and sign in, please. How are you, honey?
Hey, ladies, how you doing?
We're good.
We're good.
Go ahead, Charmaine. Go ahead.
What I wanted to say is, just from you guys' perspective, I would really like to get some suggestions or your thoughts about preparing women to be a part of the jazz world, because, you know, I'm a part of it now, and as what I find is that a lot of what you're confronting on the underbelly of jazz and getting there is sort of like a hip-hop culture, the machismo dealing with that, because while you do like mention about it's just about playing, but also the relationships that are necessary to be a part of these, the chemistry, and learning how to be a part of a man's world. Like, do you educate young women to prepare for this and how to protect themselves? And do you think it's going to take a generation of both educating men and women how to work collaboratively in a music environment?
Oh,
whoa.
Well, yes, there's a serious male culture in jazz. I mean, just pretty much any aspect of the music that you think about, at least the way we look at it today, is very kind of stereotypically male. You know, the emphasis on the individual, the competition in terms of soloing, who's the best, and the trumpet section as a whole, you know, it's a little mental asylum all of its own back there, you know, the lead players versus, you know, the old joke, how many trumpet players does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is, well, just one, but four others to stand around and tell him how he could have done it better.
Yeah,
trumpet. Yeah, trumpet sections. I mean, yeah, they're a case. But it's also the getting back to the gender stereotyping of instruments. I mean, certain instruments are considered to be for boys, and those include trumpets, trombones, drums. You know, probably bass. Although we're seeing an awful lot of good young women bass players coming up. More saxophone players than anything in terms of women, but still like 5 out of the 7 instruments that are part of the big band instrumentation are male-identified instruments. And what I do with I have about 14 private students, and half of them are girls right now. I think their parents look for me, or they look for me themselves. I teach anywhere from, you know, fourth grade to I have guys in their 70s taking lessons with me. And I tell the girls straight out to get ready. I tell them, and a lot of times I will be not invited to participate on educational panels because I do say things like that. And other educators, even especially women, are horrified that I would speak to little girls that way. On the other hand, they need to get ready. I mean, they really do. They have no idea what they're in store for. And you know, anybody who's been a trumpet player in jazz as long as I have or anything else and lived in New York and made their living, you know, in big leagues for at least part of the time can tell you so many X-rated horror stories. I mean, we cannot talk about this stuff on the radio. We cannot talk about this stuff on the radio. And it's frightening to girls. But I tell my students. In fact, I had a high school girl who was the best player in her high school here in the Bay Area, went to Northridge to study jazz, Northridge in Los Angeles, UC Northridge, or maybe it's Cal State. And they have a fairly large jazz department there run by Matt Harris. And she and the other two girls in the program were harassed so badly by the boys that they complained to the faculty, I think 17 faculty down there, all men. And everybody laughed at them. Nobody paid them any attention. So my trumpet student, got her parents to call the president of the university And they threatened a lawsuit, a sexual harassment lawsuit. It was so bad for these girls, these poor girls going to the, you know, in this program, where the faculty and the boys were pretty much ganging up on them, ostracizing them, excluding them, ignoring them, making fun of them, calling them names. I mean, come on, you want to pay for a college education and have to put up with that? Give me a break. So anyway, they threatened a lawsuit, and as a result, the university itself instituted sexual harassment awareness classes for the faculty and for that department, for the music department at the college. But as a result of her experience, she graduated a couple of years ago, and she's in law school now. She wants to be a civil rights employment attorney. Because of her horrible experiences there. She doesn't play much anymore, but she's deep in law school up here in the Bay Area. She's going to make a tremendous civil rights lawyer. But that's awesome. What her experience at Northridge did to her.
Interesting. Now, I have one more question. Do you also just prepare your girls for the hopefully this is clean cut enough to say about, you know, I don't know what the term is, I guess sexuality, for knowing how to deal with that? Because I was told early on, you know, you don't mix business with pleasure, do you? Because I think that is a challenge for women in jazz, because music is such an intimate medium that those lines between pleasure and business can get blurred very easily. And thankfully, a lot of people early on pulled me aside and said, you know, and educating young women and men about how this can affect their career. Because one of my friends, she explained, like, you know, you could be in a relationship with one of your bandmates and it can definitely cut off your ability to network, because other men won't hire you because you're so-and-so's girlfriend or boyfriend. Do you ever educate those kinds
of things? When I got married, people stopped calling me for gigs. I had some people that used to call me for gigs, and they have not called me for a gig in the last 3 years. I'm not going to name any names. You know who you are.
Hey, well, you know what? The truth of the matter is that I'm just going to say this. It's almost as though women can't get involved at all in those with whom she plays, because, yes, you are going to get viewed in a different kind of way. So, honestly, at this point, if you're a woman who's involved in music, you best become partnered with a lawyer or somebody else who's not involved in music.
Yeah. And that's a challenge, because a lot of what jazz is shedding with your bandmates. And I think that's one of the challenges, too, as music education gets better, is that to really learn jazz, you have to have the right relationships with the right cats to learn, you know, certain things to learn. Because a lot of jazz education is still, I don't know if you find that, Amy or Ellen, that is so, I guess you could say, esoteric, and who the right cats to listen to, how you approach the harmony, because jazz, you know, getting these relationships and shedding with people is so much a part of the culture, you know, educating young women about that, because I had to learn a few things the hard way, but as I get older and there's more, like, stuff on YouTube, I think people can learn different ways in educating themselves about the music.
That's a good question, really.
Yeah, that's been a long-term problem, the girls and women thing at jazz sessions. In fact, girls don't want to participate. They get put on the spot. Generally, they don't have the same kind of experience, and they don't have fun, and they don't look good, and they don't have the confidence, the self-confidence, or the experience to step up and call their own tunes. So they get stuck playing on things they don't know very well. They're just not one of the boys. And so I think that girls need to get together and do some of this for themselves. I don't see any problem with a bunch of girls at the university, women, young women, or in high school getting together and running their own sessions, or at least playing a large part in them. I think if they... You know, there's safety in numbers, and there's also a certain amount of attention that gets paid to women in numbers as opposed to
trying to do it all on our own all the time.
Yes.
And there are enough women and girls out there. You know, girls who are looking to play jazz should look for like-minded girls and women. They desperately need mentors. They really do. So I hope that some of your audience are women jazz educators. And I would ask them to, you know, be proactive in this sort of thing. I believe in affirmative action. I wish other people did. Step up and, you know, volunteer help. Organize a girls' jazz day. Organize a girls' jazz camp. Show your students, male and female, that wonderful new film, The Girls in the Band, and the one that's about to come out, hopefully, But Can She Play? There are plenty of materials out there now. There are examples to point to. There are materials. Nobody knows that it's all guys on Jamie Abersalt's play-alongs. And I hate to give money to Jamie Abersalt, who's one of the biggest jazz bigots in the country, and I can't believe they gave him an NEA Jazz Award this year. That guy has done more to keep women out of jazz than any other single person I know.
Wow.
He, you know, is giving the NEA, giving a Jazz Masters Award to Jamie Abersalt is like the Governors Association giving an award to George Wallace.
Wow.
You know, this guy is a wart on the ass of progress in jazz. Last year, his summer jazz workshop, which is the oldest in the country and possibly the biggest at the University of Louisville, has 63 instrumental faculty and not one woman.
Mm. Oh, my God.
There are still, and he has all his educator guy friends defending him, saying, well, girls don't need to see women. We can be role models for them. Now, how a serious educator can make a statement like that is just incomprehensible and ridiculous.
You need to make him your own certificate. Mail him something nice. Go trim on it. I made this for you. You are a wart on the ass of jazz.
Oh, my God. And see, here's the thing. We, I'm talking especially about Wynton Marsalis, and those kinds of high-profile jazz musicians, we deify these guys. We
not
put
me.
Them on pedestals that are so
no,
high.
Count me out.
Well, I understand that, but look, he's got a nice little tasty job at CBS now, ongoing. On some of these shows. So
yep.
I mean, it's like, oh, Wynton's here. Hey, Wynton, what do you have to say?
Oh,
it's like the second coming of Jesus.
Well, you know, the viewers and supporters WGBH in Boston are demanding that they get David Koch off of their board of directors.
Mm.
So I think we need to start doing things like that around guys like Wynton Marsalis. I don't know if you're aware of this movement, but we know who David Koch is and that he's bought a number of state governments around the country and that he's
absolutely
trying to send us. Okay, so he is the president of the board of WGBH Public Television in Boston, which is one of the bigger stations in the country. And he is a serious climate denier. You know, he puts all kinds of money into denying climate change. And people are starting to recognize that, you know, public television and its listeners and what it stands for should not be polluted by guys like David Koch as their president of their board of directors.
Absolutely.
And so people have been calling in and going online all over the country and giving the station a one-star review on their Facebook page or on their website and complaining about David Koch and demanding that the station get rid of him. You know, that's what's going to have to happen to guys like Wynton Marsalis. I don't think he walks on water. I don't think Jamie Abersalt walks on water. Those two guys alone have done more to keep women out of jazz than possibly everybody else in the business right now, as far as I'm concerned. And I don't know why people deify Wynton. I really don't. And what's the matter with CBS? You know, really,
I can definitely say why he's deified. He's feeding a lot of people, and I think that's always the challenge that I've noticed. You know, people have these strong stances, but you know, when it gets down to it, I've been through a few battles here, and I could tell you, as long as people are getting gigs and being fed by a certain person, no one is willing to fight them, to let their money.
We need the Jazz Grandmothers Network or something, because I think when the ones of us who manage to survive and are still doing what we do in our 60s and beyond, you know, I don't plan to be incapacitated in 6 years when I reach 70. We need to say that the emperor has no clothes. And we need to keep saying it and saying it and saying it in spite of the kind of really nasty flack we're going to get. I have been pilloried on Facebook on a lot of the groups that I'm in by merely posting my recent interview about the rally I'm holding by guys on these networks, and they don't know anything about it. They're not interested in, you know, the results of what happened when orchestras instituted blind auditions in terms of employment of women. They don't care about Winton's policies, which are crony, involve cronyism, and are possibly illegal. I really think the EEOC needs to take a look into his operation up there and the whole organization of Jazz at Lincoln Center. But we need to squawk and squawk and squawk some more. And as Hillary Clinton said, we need to grow rhinoceros skin, which is difficult for women, and just plow through and just ignore the boys and their nasty. I've been called an asshole so many times on Facebook in the last week.
They didn't call you a bitch? Now I'm kind of disappointed. I prefer bitch.
They've been calling me an asshole, basically.
Oh, wow.
That's not even true.
So I don't resort to name calling, but I will say that someone's comments are sexist, and I will say that Winton's lack of audition policies are possibly illegal, and they exclude women. And we need to have fair and equal. This is a labor issue. We need fair and equal access. Period. It's a labor issue.
I feel like this is an overriding concept in our culture, because we don't have enough money coming into the arts, and people are getting grubby and people are getting political, and they can't have that kind of weight that Charmaine was talking about over you to mute your voice politically because they're giving you money if you have other opportunities to get funding for your art. I just went to Sweden in November, and over there, everything is funded through government programs. And I have a couple of Swedish people coming to my festival this year. And I spoke at a conference on women and equality for women at festivals. And there, if you get government funding for your festival, like, you know, the DC Jazz Festival gets funding from the NEA, you are required to have at least 50% of the people on your festival be women.
Well, we have those laws here. For example, the Newport Jazz Festival, which is run by George Wein Productions, which I believe is a nonprofit, this year has no women headliners out of their, 30-some acts. There are some women side women. Grace Kelly is playing in one of the big bands. And the festival group itself includes Anat Cohen. But if you look at the list of headliners, it's guys' names or names of the ensemble. There are no women headliners at the Newport Jazz Festival this year. Why is that? They're all over the place. I mean, Terry Lynn Carrington just won a huge Grammy. Why isn't she on these festivals along with her trio? Who's the sax player?
Jerry Allen, for heaven's sake.
Jerry Allen. There's a ton of them. I mean, I could list 40 or 50.
Yes.
And who's the young woman who won the
Thelonious
Monk? No, the Thelonious
Monk.
This young woman saxophonist from Chile who won
Aldana.
The Thelonious Monk. The first time in 28 years or something that a woman has won. Melissa Aldana was the first woman to win the very prestigious but maybe not well-publicized Thelonious Monk
competition, which I think part of the prize is a record contract with Blue Note Records. And this is the first time a woman has won this since 1987. And so you know, if this were when Ambrose won it a few years ago, who is a trumpet player from Berkeley High, everybody in the press jumped all over him. He had tours lined up for years. He went right into the studio. He was on television. He was everywhere. Now, this happened months ago, you know, Melissa Aldana, and we don't even know about her.
Haven't heard a word since.
Yeah, see?
Haven't had a single word. I had to fight to remember her name. And I'll say this, too, and we've actually, Charmaine, I wrote a note to you. I didn't want to say this publicly, but it's okay now. I don't feel as though if there are any repercussions, and especially since he's in town at Blues Alley, I'm going to say it. I was so shocked to see the other day that Lee Ritenour, who has this now very famous string theory competition that he does, he actually had an advisory board with pictures the other day, and I felt my stomach turn over. There was not a single woman on this advisory committee, not a single one.
Well, I don't know if that's worse or the fact that more than half of the board of directors of Jazz at Lincoln Center are women. You know, they're both frightening as far as I'm concerned. You know, if women are in control but for some reason cannot identify, you know, with other women, they're not doing us any good. You know, and it's, you know, as
very
far as all guy guitar players, where are people like Cheryl Bailey and Mimi Fox and a whole bunch of others? There's some frightening women guitarists in this country.
Oh, my God. Joyce Cooling is one of the most superb guitarists I know. And
she's a Bay Area artist.
Yes.
Or was.
Yes.
Yeah, and Mimi Fox lives here, and Cheryl Bailey is at, you know, Berkeley and Boston. You know, young women, young, I mean 30s or even 40s, are coming out of the woodwork. They're everywhere. And how they manage to get to be so good is, you know, that's what I'm amazed at, that they manage to get to be so good with so many opportunities denied them.
But, you know, you get to be that good, and then what happens? Well,
I guess Lee Ritenour doesn't invite you to be on his, you
know. Oh, you're getting muffled, and I want to hear that part. you're getting muffled, Ellen, and I want to say what you just said again.
Where are these women on his big important boy guitar thing?
And
we're all supposed to be real impressed with.
I could say more about that, but I'll let it go for right now because the point is made. And I'll tell you, Amy, this, and you, Charmaine, and Ellen, I think that I made mention of this. My 21-year-old son and I were having a discussion, and of course, he's always jumping on me for what he perceives that I say as being negative, because he is the sensitive soul who's always looking to make sure the underdog feels better. So, you know, we had this conversation, and he said, look, in all fairness, maybe Lee Ritenour just didn't think about it. And I was driving, and I almost went off the road. I said, honey, that's even worse. That's even worse. He didn't think about it, and he went, oh, yeah. Whoa. So, Ellen, we can't hear you.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
Cal W. Royal quote, who wrote a very interesting op-ed piece on...
you're going in and out. You're muffled right now.
Can you still hear, can you hear me now?
Just a little bit.
Really? Okay. Any better?
No.
No. How is this?
No.
You're not picking me up anymore?
No, it's like you suddenly went underwater.
How about now? Is this any better?
Yes. Yeah, that's it. That's
okay,
it.
Sorry. Anyway, I wanted to read a quick quote from Royal Stokes, who says that jazz is far behind not only American society, but behind all other performing arts and all other musical genres in demolishing gender discrimination. And this was written a few years back, and it is so true. And we have to recognize that, that it's a fact. And Nat Hentoff is another one who's written about this issue extensively in the press. So this is not a big surprise to anybody who's paying attention. And if Lee Ritenour didn't think about it, it's because he didn't want to.
I clearly see that, and that's why it came as such a shock, because you begin to it's certainly somebody who is like me, who has been playing or been enamored with these artists for so long, and then you realize when a decision is made like that, that you have been focused on making sure people are promoted that could care less about you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real revelation.
Well, that's, you know, some kind of passive discrimination again. You know, like he's putting together, you know, his little guitar summit, and he's going to hire people that he's comfortable with. And so who is Lee Ritenour comfortable with? He's comfortable with guys who are like him. People who are like him. So that's who he's going to hire and be comfortable with. But, boy, I wonder if he's getting any public money, because, you know, we just have to start looking at this possibly from a legal perspective as well as just generally organizing ourselves.
And this is an aside, too. You don't know how right you are about surrounding yourself with people who are like you, because in actuality, of that group of men who are on his advisory committee who are guitarists, one of them is African-American. One.
I'm surprised there's that many, frankly. I mean, I don't know how many there are, but, I mean, I just see, well, look at Winton's band. I mean, you know, Winton fired everyone over 30 shortly after he took the reins of that orchestra. And you should check out that Village Voice article back from 2000 called Boy Dig Boy, Where Are the Women? By Laura Pellegrinelli, who actually organized the first protest back then at Lincoln Center during their big fundraiser. And there was a bunch of stuff in the press, but that was the year 2000. Here we are in 2014, and nothing has changed. But Winton's band is, I mean, take a look at the picture of his band. It just smacks you right in the face. It's all guys who look like him, or all but one or two, and no women. And you just cannot, you know, legally get away with that type of thing anymore, unless, like you said, you know, you're just organizing your buddies to get together and read some charts through and drink some beer on Sunday afternoon at your local school or something, you know. You can't do that if you're running jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra.
Well, you know, it's go ahead.
I was just saying, I think going towards the future, I think because of technology and things, what Trish is doing and having servant leaders who are bringing awareness to this issue, I think the future is going to look brighter because of people supporting Washington Women in Jazz and, you know, just artists learning how to articulate their position, whether it be for arts in schools or such issues as this. And I think the more we educate each other about how to express these things, things will get better. As more as you're putting it out there and explaining why this is important, I think the future is going to look a lot brighter. That's my optimistic lookout.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right.
You're right, but when I was your age, I said the same thing, and it ain't any better.
Well, you know what? Seriously, Ellen, you've been doing this for so long, and I'll bet you have felt alone a time or two. Just by having this conversation today, I'm reminded of what I learned at my 3 years at QVC. The most important thing that I learned as being a call center rep, working myself up to a network coordinator, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. But more importantly, the more squeaky wheels there are, as Daryl Issa is finding out in the House of Representatives.
I'm loving that, man.
I am loving it. The more people relay the information, we have our eye on you, and it's not just a few of us. There are quite a few of us looking to see what you're going to do, your next move. It really does make a difference. So as you said, and Ellen, you made a great point about women making sure that they have numbers. Women in numbers do make an impact on men who are watching, because if you're by yourself, you're putting yourself in a vulnerable position. If you have mm-hmm. other women around you who know how to play and know how to conduct themselves, they honestly don't know what to do.
And well,
to
yes,
say,
we are very powerful that way. We are formidable that way.
Yes.
Yeah, and just going back to the issue, like you said, it hasn't gotten better. Well, one issue is that most people don't even know that jazz still exists. Like for me, I didn't even know, like growing up in Northern Virginia, I didn't even think combo jazz was still in existence. Not until 2008 mm-hmm. when I went to go hang out with a college friend did I know that combo jazz was still alive. There's sort of like this cultural barrier between jazz and middle America that I can testify to, that most people don't even know jazz still exists. Like people think jazz is Kenny G. And so there is this cultural barrier between that has existed between middle America and jazz that is only now recently being overcome with technology. Because I was talking to Greg, and that's kind of what I do, because I'm an internet marketing person. That's my main bread and butter. Is I was talking to Greg Thomas of the New York Daily, and he was just saying how jazz is behind, not just culturally in terms of gender issues, but also technology-wise, about how people are getting exposed to the music. Because again, when I was growing up, I knew more about Robert E. Lee and never even heard about Lee Morgan. I never even heard about, you know, and that's why I do help support women in Washington, Women in Jazz, and Capital Bop, another organization, because there is this culture barrier between middle America and jazz that has to come down so that you can get reinforcement, so that women in middle America know about this, just like with soccer and a lot of stuff. It's just been this whole cultural barrier between certain, segments of society that I think that you're going to see a lot more, at least that's why I'm supporting Washington Women in Jazz, is because women do need to know about this. And, penetrating into Northern Virginia and other surrounding areas where you have very proactive women, you're going to get those reinforcements to fight this battle, I believe.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, because I have been out here a long time, a lot by myself, getting beat up pretty regularly. And I have to say it's affected how I feel about the profession and about the music. I don't feel really bitter about it. I don't think I'm jaded, but I have other interests. And when I think about playing jazz with anything other than my own big band, which I love and have loads of fun with, it just doesn't interest me like it used to. It just doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what?
It's got so much baggage attached to it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean.
but listen, you know what, Ellen? Charmaine raised a good point, and that made me think about Arnold Strickland, who's coming up next hour. He's one of these just beautifully generous spirits who's everywhere as far as his music is concerned. He wants to do everything. One of the interesting things about Arnold is, more than a musician, and he values that, he values his teaching experience. He's had a wide array of different kinds of private and on-staff teaching experiences. But I see that he teaches students in Japan via Skype.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that idea that there are kids in Japan, and maybe there are adults involved as well, who are learning about American jazz via this effervescent personality who loves it. And maybe that's a way, as Charmaine has indicated, a way to explore new opportunities to make sure that since we don't have the education now in schools, so that girls can't learn how to play instruments as much as we were able to back in the day, maybe we can do so via this kind of methodology more and more.
Well, for me, you know, I shouldn't say that I don't enjoy the music, I guess. I don't enjoy freelancing with bands that are generally male in the Bay Area. And I don't do a lot of that. I don't get called for a lot of that. I'm also not crazy about being out till 2 a.m. anymore on the weekends. I want to be in bed by that time now, you know. But I'm getting a huge charge out of my young girl students, trumpet students. And I'm a jazz specialist, so I teach trumpet. You know, you first got to be able to play the instrument before you can learn how to play jazz. So that's where I'm at with these girls. And they have a wonderful support system here in the Bay Area that it's taken some of us years to create. And they're going to have a wildly different experience coming up than I did, for example, or even somebody in their 40s possibly did. And to me, that's the exciting thing about what's going on in the music for me right now. Plus, of course, my big band, which I love, you know.
That's
and
we're so
recording
awesome.
Again this year. That's also exciting. So, yeah, I shouldn't. But you know, if I'm driving around, I'll probably put on National Public Radio as opposed to slide in a CD anymore and listen to music. I just sometimes need to get away from it.
Oh yeah, I would imagine, because you fought a really tremendous fight, and you've accomplished a great deal. But it's really, I mean, we were talking about this, and Amy and Charmaine, you're younger, and it's not to cast any dispersions in that regard. It's just that honestly, Ellen and I were talking about this, and we figured, you know what? And I'll just say it. After you reach 60, we're figuring, what the hell? Let's stir up the embers here, okay?
Mm-hmm. Right. We have nothing to lose.
Right.
Well, that's good. I hope I just get crazier with age like you guys, so that'll be fun.
I hope so, too.
Well,
that'll be ideal, because I don't know where I'll be at 60. I'll just be wild.
Yeah.
I have two more interviews this afternoon about the
Go
rally.
Go ahead, baby. Go ahead.
And I'm going to speak to a reporter in about 20 minutes from the San Francisco Chronicle. So I want to say goodbye, but I want to thank all three of you so much for this discussion. It's been really, really good for me. Good luck with the Washington, D.C. Festival. And I hope that we can stay in touch because, you know, together we are formidable, and there's
yes.
a lot of work to do. So
God bless you, Ellen. Thank you.
Oh, back
man.
At
thank you.
So
Ellen.
Thank you all, and let's stay in touch.
Yes, we will. We promise.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Wow. Wow, Amy and Charmaine. Wow.
Getting crazy.
You know, it's just, man, she is an eye-opener, is she not?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild.
It's very interesting, because while she was talking, I saw on Facebook that they have a Girls Day Jazz that Terry Lynn, I guess she's a part of, at Jazz at Lincoln Center, so... You know, she may not be on now, but just to encourage her that her battle is not in vain. I mean, when you think of all the minority groups that have been fighting in America for a long time, I mean, you talk about the civil rights movement and, you know, 50 years later, Obama is elected president. And, you know, her, hopefully when she's laid to rest or soon, that she'll understand that her battles and her battle scars were not in vain because progress is happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, and look, if you can say that, Charmaine, because you know you're an African American woman who is in a scenario that has had some challenges in one way and maybe not so much in another. But when you say that, your words carry weight, because I don't know what kinds of one-to-ones you've had with men in regard to playing within that group, but I know that you have overwhelming support from some men because I know the same men that you do. So,
yeah.
You know, it's...
It definitely is a challenge. I think it's about, you know, I've learned it's about boundaries, and I think that's where women now these days are getting empowered to set boundaries. Like, yeah, they may come out the mouth at you kind of wrong and crazy sometimes, but you just have to let them know, hey, bro, I'm not about that. Let's be about the music. And, you know, you're going to have to go through both men and women with that. I mean, my relationships with both genders has always been challenging in different ways when you're dealing with white jazz musicians or black jazz musicians, male or female. There's always some sort of challenge that you have to overcome, but I believe if you're putting that positive energy out there and setting boundaries, you'll eventually connect to the right people to move your career forward. That's what I honestly believe. I met
Definitely.
Amy. We don't look like alike. We're different, but our value and love for supporting women is what brings us together. And I think those sort of sacrifices is really going to pay big dividends in the future. I believe that.
Oh, for sure.
Definitely.
And, you know, there's a couple of things. First of all, let me just say this about what you said, Charmaine. Recently, like past 24, 48 hours, I was thinking about some women who truly did pave the way. And two of those women that did were Lil Hardin Armstrong and Mary Lou Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those women were such that just by the mere fact of the strength of their personality and their artistry, it commanded the attention of men around them. They made it a point to mentor men. And I think mm-hmm. that may have made a difference in how men perceived of them, because then it gave them an additional opportunity to see what kind of artists they really were as well. So when you have that mentorship in mind and sort of turning the tables, as opposed to twirling your hair and going, oh, you're so big and strong, you play so much better than me. you go the opposite route and say, I'll bet you that I can make you sound better, and this is what I do. This is why I think that I have the authority to say that. Or something along those lines that there's been a wonderful group of female jazz instrumentalists through the years that have really stuck out now in doing some research about them and knowing why they were so beloved. They were beloved because men considered them to be equals, and it was by the way that they conducted themselves.
Exactly.
It's just a beautiful thing, a beautiful thing.
Well, I think exactly what you said with Mary Lou Williams, you know, all the people coming through her house, you know, the history of the people who came through there, and Art Tatum and Monk, and, you know, and I spent a lot of time with Billy Taylor before he passed, and I'm so grateful for that, because he really gave me an understanding of his relationship with Mary Lou Williams and how that, you know, had really stuck with him his entire life. And you look at the things that he set up, the Jazzmobile, the Mary Lou Williams Jazz Festival, all the programming he did at the Kennedy Center, really was with that in mind. And to me, that's why I get kind of disappointed with Wynton Marsalis, because he could be an advocate for women. He could be a Billy Taylor type figure in the lives of female jazz musicians, and he's not stepping up to the plate, and he's not seeing that that's a problem. And you know, Billy Taylor, I just read, there's a new autobiography that was ghostwritten. I can't remember the beautiful author's name, but she's out of Indiana University, and she put out this book. She did a series of interviews with him, and one of the interviews with Billy Taylor said, you know, he... when he played at the Howard Theater in D.C., there was, they had a talent competition, and the woman that played before him completely crushed the piano and never went on to having a career, and he blew it and continued to have this whole huge career because she had no support system. She had nothing, nothing in D.C. to give her a position to work as a musician without an extremely aggressive attitude, she couldn't do anything. So it's just, and that always stuck with him, is that, this woman who was amazing and, could cut him in circles, couldn't get a gig. So he always sort of stayed with that, and moving forward, that was so important to him. And that's why, the Kennedy Center has been a bit of a disappointment to me since, its transition from Billy Taylor, because that same interest in women has seemed to have mellowed out, and last year they decided that was going to be the last year that they had all female acts for the Women in Jazz Festival. And now it's just the Mary Lou Williams Festival, and they have, their first all-male act this year, and nobody's really talking about that. But that's a big issue. Like, why wouldn't you just create another jazz festival if you think there needs to be, some of these men, you just put them at some other point in the programming. Why do you need to put them on this festival that was specifically created for opportunities for women to showcase themselves at a high level?
Yeah, so, I did think about that a lot. That was kind of one of those blows too. That was a stomach punch. You try to understand, and has there been any discussion as to why those circumstances have changed?
When this article came out last year, which I thought was kind of bizarrely written, but it's on the Washington Post, and I'm quoted in it as well. And the guy in the interview was very unkind to me and called me caustic and put how old I was, but didn't put the name of my jazz festival. And, it wasn't exactly a great interview on my part, but you can see, I wasn't very friendly. But, you can see what was going on at the Kennedy Center in their mind. And when he interviews them, he says, why did you think this was the time to move away from all female headliners for a Women in Jazz Festival when it's been selling out every year since it started? Why did you think you were going to change it up? And they said that basically that they think, Women in Jazz Festivals have become, kind of a relic. Like, they're no longer necessary, Racism is dead. We're in the new modern world. We have Obama, and we have, Carolyn Carrington winning Grammys and Melissa Aldana. So clearly, it's all over.
Who's running the Kennedy Center? John Boehner? I mean, I'm confused. wow! It's no longer necessary? Is that a quote?
I don't know. I think they actually said that it was a bit pejorative. The women in jazz term was a bit pejorative.
Man.
So,
yeah. And I think that is one of the challenges that you have, like, always talking about ethnic and identity issues, is that it really comes down to who people are surrounded by and what they're exposed to. And I just, in my industry, the IT world, we talk about information silos. Like, people don't, until people are connecting and having these conversations with diverse people groups, it's hard to really, for people to have perspective. Like, when that Nicholas Payton thing happened, they had, like, three of the loudest people, talking about these issues about race and jazz, and they don't have scholars. Like, I think, jazz in particular still needs to develop relationship with, feminine, different diverse groups of feminine scholars, diverse groups of ethnomusicologists. And I think going forward, we really do have to, jazz in some way. I know Capital Bop is moving towards that, about having non-musicians, outsiders, really, give their perspective about things that I think sometimes being a jazz insider where you're, like, touring all the time. Like, a lot of jazz musicians are so disconnected from the rest of the world and what's going on because they're just touring and they're in this, like, touring, lifestyle.
We're just trying to make a dollar, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. That really has validity because, if you live inside that box and you don't know what folks are talking about that is really crucial to your day-to-day that would make you think otherwise, like, I have to say this, I say this with a large grain of salt, but I'm very much aware And Charmaine, you in particular might get this because I know your posts through the past couple of years, but a blueprint in childhood means so much. You can hardly shake that blueprint. And, you know, here's Wynton Marsalis. He's had a family of all boys. Mom stayed home and did the cooking. And that's what he came to understand about women. So when you have that blueprint, you know, it's really hard unless you get some people on a day-to-day saying, you know what, you got to be thinking differently. You know, women are much more than cookers, cleaners, and sexual partners. Women can also pay bills, front bands, and play trombone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the more whatever creative kinds of endeavors, and you are full of them, Charmaine, because you create websites, whatever creative endeavors we can do to get information in front of people so that folks know, coming off the road, hey, look at what people are thinking and saying. That makes no sense, or that makes every bit of sense, or something. It will disable that bubble that they're living in.
Mm-hmm.
Am I just rambling?
No, it's the truth. It's the truth. You know, that's what we were talking about with blind auditions. Melissa Aldana crushed the competition, right? You know,
yes.
We all saw this. We all witnessed this. And, you know, that's great. I'm glad she won the competition. I'm, you know, even when they were looking at her, they still let her win. And, you know, I'm just frustrated to see the lack of response in the jazz community by being like, hey, she just won this incredibly prestigious competition, and nobody's saying anything. You know, we've had no other female instrumentalists win the Hmong competition. We've only had female singers win the Hmong competition. So,
doggone it, where is she? I'm going to book her to this show.
I know, right? What kind of number? But it's true. It's, you know, it's frustrating to see that.
I wish we had more organizations that were like this. Charmaine, pick it up,
yes.
Because Amy's losing her voice.
I know. It's all over. I didn't open up last night.
My God. Well, you know, this is really, I mean, it's gone on longer. Why am I not surprised that this has gone on longer than I thought? Why? Ask why. Carla Chisholm is in the chat room. Carla! And not that long ago, she got back from France, and she poses a question. She said, where can I find a definitive source for females getting together who play instrumental jazz in the area? So, ladies?
Wow. Well, Sunday we have an all-female band for the DC Jazz Jam as a promotion for the festival. So that'll be me and Karen Chaplain and Lydia Lewis and Lee Pilder. So we'll be down this Sunday at Dalek on 18th, and so that's 6:30 to 9:30. If you come down there, there's always a lot of women that we get out. Charmaine was there last year. We had a wild time.
I'll bet. If Charmaine's there, it's guaranteed.
Now put the pressure on. Charmaine, you better be there.
Okay.
You don't have enough to do. Come on down.
Charmaine,
how did your gig go? And I'm going to get back to where Carla can reach out, but Charmaine, how did your gig go with Mark Evans?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. It definitely was a lot of fun. I got a lot of chop work to do. I know from my end, just from a musicianship standpoint, I got to get more hours on the horn between making websites and raising kids, but it was definitely a lot of fun. And I'm looking actually for it now to March 21st, where I'm doing a Woman in Jazz thing at Andy Music with Amashandra, Janelle Gill, and Savannah Harris.
Ooh!
I'm up for that, and, you know, I'm slowly building my own little career slowly but surely, but I'm actually, you know, the music is one thing, but just to be a part of the community and support other young musicians is really what I'm the most passionate about. You know, not just the music, but just supporting people.
Good.
You're my big fan. I'll take you in.
It really does make a difference when, you know, you are going forward. But as you go forward, you always have that hand reaching out in the back of you. That makes every bit of difference in the world. And Carla's husband, the amazing Todd Guggen, said, "Oh, wow, those names went by really fast. Oh, Amy, could you please tell Carla again what she needs to do?"
Sure, who's going to? I mean, I can just start randomly listing every single female jazz musician that I know and love in the area. But you know Charmaine. yes, on Sunday we'll be playing at 6:30 in at Dalloc at 18th and U. All this stuff is on the website, thewashingtonwomenandjazz.com. And also on our Facebook page, which is, you know, facebook.com/www.jazzfest.
Yep, and she just said,
friends with me.
She said, found it, so she's happy now.
Okay, good. So
That's awesome.
I've got great women coming down, and Lydia, great drummer, put out her own album 2 years ago, and she actually is driving all the way out from West Virginia to come play at the festival. So we're extending the Washington Women in Jazz to West Virginia Women in Jazz. And
please don't.
Playing on Sunday. No, I can't make it all the way out there. And then Karen Chapdelaine is like one of the top call bassists in D.C. She's incredible. She's a French-Canadian powerhouse. And that, I mean, we want to talk about people who don't mess around. I've been on gigs with Karen for example, we were playing at Howard University, and the president of Howard University came over, and we had played his Christmas party. And this was like mid-February, and we still hadn't gotten a check. So Karen, instead of going over to his secretary, went straight to the president of the university and was like, "Hey, I really enjoyed your Christmas party. When do you think I'm going to get paid?"
Oh, wow.
Do not play. The French-Canadian does not play.
Oh, my God. I love that. That's
a
chutzpah.
Businesswoman. Mm. She is not playing around. So I love to play with her because she's one of the most straightforward, kind people, and I adore her. So she's playing on a ton of things, including our Wednesday night big gala show, where we're bringing in Mary Halverson, the wonderful guitarist, and Allison Miller for a WWJF reunion. Allison Miller is coming down Wednesday, March 19th. So that's our big gala show with Karen and Sarah Hughes and also Jimmy Branch, trumpet player. So it's going to be wild. This is it.
Yeah, you picked out a lot of names there. And actually, I want to make sure that before Arnold comes around, I wanted to play Integrity Reeves because I'm real excited about this EP release event that opens up. Yep. I love her, and folks have to know that if you know that name, you remember Afro Blue from the sing-off on NBC. That was the shiggity right there. That group, oh, my God. It had people, like, talking from coast to coast because they were just so on point all the time. But Integrity's part of that. And I better get both of you off. So I mean, I could do this for another hour.
All right, but I'm not leaving until I say my website again. So WashingtonWomenInJazz.com. Please, everybody who's listening later, listening now, anyone, anywhere, you can donate online. Just go to our website and click on the link, and it's tax deductible. We have perks on there. I got T-shirts. I got MP3 downloads. I have tickets. We have perks for you to pledge your support to our festival. So I really, really appreciate you having us on the air today, Trish and Charmaine. I love you.
Aww.
Love you too, girl.
Love you both.
Okay.
I want to be part of the bonding here. Charmaine, thanks for your input too, because it was real. I couldn't have possibly left you in the chat room to be twiddling your thumbs. You had to have some input here.
Hey, I'm blessed for your input.
Chat room.
I'm blessed for those words. I'm blessed for those words. I'm gonna put it in.
Oh God. Well, listen, this is going to be awesome. And if we go to the website, Amy, we'll find out about the Indiegogo project, right?
Yes, right there on the front page.
Okay. That's what I want
to
know.
Push the button.
push the button, see?
You can also see a list of the people who've supported us already. I have a whole page of supporters and organizations that we're partnering with this year and, you know, people who have individually supported. So I'm putting them all on blast.
Okay, that's awesome. Well, great. Both of you, Amy, because you're doing this and you have continued to inspire so many, I mean men and women, both with this Washington Women in Jazz Festival, it's really big. And Charmaine, you're such a voice and you do your entrepreneurial skills so well and you make sure people are on blast a lot. Because you need to make sure that we're on our toes. So I know that you're going to do well. Keep in touch with me about your gig at On D because I want to make sure that that gets an event page or gets posted or promoted, okay?
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah. Of course you know I'm going to do that. It's an all-female gig, and you've got some formidable talent there. Of course.
No,
yes,
no.
I am. Thanks, Mama Bear.
You're welcome, my daughter. All right. Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Charmaine. I loved it. Loved it.
All right. Thank you so much, Trish. See you soon.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, man, we got to do this. We have to play Integrity Reeves before we turn our attention to Arnold Strickland, which is another vibe entirely. Integrity Reeves, when she was on the show, she gave me a handful of songs, and this is one of those songs called Why Try to Change Me Now.
Just can't. your clown, so why try to change me?
Have mercy. We had no idea that we were going to go so over, but we just could not stop yapping. I would ordinarily say, you know how women get, but that sounds sexist, even from my mouth. But we just had such a wonderful time, and I had to get that song in. And Arnold Strickland is on hold for me, and I'm going to get to him momentarily. I want you to know that that was Integrity Reeves, and she's going to kick off the Washington Women in Jazz Festival that's happening. If you go to my Facebook page and see my timeline photo, all the information is right there. March the 15th through the 22nd. And if you go to washingtonwomeninjazz.com, you'll find out the information about the Indiegogo Project if you are so inclined to support. Integrity Reeves right there. And this gentleman, wow. Let me tell you about this man. I don't know when he sleeps. I am so serious. He has delved into classical guitar, jazz guitar, rock, vast experience as a private studies teacher, as a faculty member. He is indeed a consummate guitarist who not only teaches one-to-one and on staff, especially Berkeley, those are his roots, but he also teaches via Skype to students in Japan. He is well-versed in hip-hop, rock, blues, and jazz. I would definitely call him a vibey, avant-garde, jazz, etc., certainly hybrid artist. He's amazing, a composer, guitarist, teacher, and real strong personality. We have never spoken one-to-one, just in communication, so my little heart is fluttering. If you would please make welcome Arnold Strickland.
Hi, how are you, Trish?
I'm so good. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for the fantastic introduction. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Arnold, you are so different than anyone that I have interviewed on this show, and I'm tickled because I'm not sure folks are ready.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm ready, but, you know, we're going to we're gonna try to proceed and make it as fun as possible.
And look, the reason why we're doing this show on Friday as opposed to Thursday is because you have this intense schedule. How many days of the week? You pretty much teach every day, do you not?
Well, no, I teach basically about 4 days a week, you know, for a couple hours a day, but well, really about 5 days a week. You know, I do some private teaching, and then I teach at a classical music school, and I teach for CUNY, and I teach for the Bronx Arts Ensemble. So, you know, I'm pretty much hustling my guitar all over New York.
Yeah, and you know, you're so fascinating to me. What is it about?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. What is it about music that compels you? I know that you make it a point to tell your students to strive for creativity, and I love that because you focus on them being authentic as opposed to them sounding like anybody else. But what is it that drives you? What is it that you want to do with your music on a day-to-day or even in the long haul?
Well, basically, you know, that's a very good question. I just tried basically to – well, first of all, I study jazz every day. So,
oh, I'll bet you
know,
do.
No matter what it is, I study, you know, all the greats. But, you know, my influences are – you know, I listen to a lot of rock and roll. I grew up with rock and roll as a kid.
Yep.
A lot of soul music. A lot of bebop, you know, a lot of country music. A lot of classical music. So for me, I just, you know, I try not to pit one over the other. I just let my influences just come to me naturally.
Well, that's cool. And I have to make mention of Strychnine too, because that's one of your endeavors. You actually have a trio, and you're actually part of, at least that's what I heard from you, a hip-hop experimental band. So when we say that Arnold Strickland is involved in a wide array of music, it's almost an understatement. You love it all, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I really do. And, you know, I think sometimes, you know, people try to, I guess in their haste, that, you know, people want to ascribe certain sort of, you know, quantifiable attributes to musicians to, you know, sort of maybe, you know, pigeonhole them or shoehorn them into neat little bags. But, you know, for me, it's, you know, I'm interested in just so many styles of music. And, you know, I always, and even as a teacher, I never try to force my students to learn jazz, for instance. And, for instance, I have a student, his name is Malcolm Brickhouse, and he started studying with me when he was 5 years old, and now he's just a guitar phenomena. You're going to definitely hear from him,
wow.
I never forced any jazz on him. But he's one of the few black kids that is into heavy metal. So you know now he's starting to tour all over the world.
I love that.
And I love it too. It's really, really fantastic. And you know, and as someone who is a teacher who loves guitar, you know, I really try to do is just to impart just the love of the music. And I don't want to force anything on anyone. I just want to make sure that they stay as creative as possible.
And that's, you know, such an interesting underbelly to this conversation, which is that, you know, we were talking about this, I had three ladies and me discussing women in jazz. And, you know, through the years, we get told about stereotypes. And those stereotypes can get in the way, especially when we have people that we respect say, oh, well, you can't do that, for example, you just said. If somebody who was this young Brickhouse gentleman, if somebody said to him, oh, well, you know what? You're African American. You can't be doing heavy metal. Come on. Nobody does that.
Exactly.
That's ridiculous.
Exactly.
Who's making up the rules as we go along? Who makes these rules?
Maybe society, society for sure. You know, society, I think, and record labels, you know, and people that control certain venues but that's why I love being on your show, because your show is, you know, just the term hybrid jazz. It just, you know, for me, it means so much because, you know, I'm definitely a hybrid. You know, if there ever was anyone who was a hybrid, for sure, I'm definitely a hybrid.
Honey, of all the people that have been on this show, you are the king of hybridity.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, and you said the perfect response. Thank you so much. No, I mean, you will not be compromised. You will not be boxed. And you do it with such a smile. I mean, you are just smiling through your life, and you have such joy in what you do. It's just, it was a no-brainer for me to say, you know what? I won't do the show on Thursday. I'll do it Friday because Arnold can do it then. It just worked out so well.
Yes.
Wow. So,
and, you know,
go ahead.
I was going to say, Trish, you know, for me, it's an honor to be a jazz musician. I mean, it's the greatest honor I could have in my life, really.
Wow.
I couldn't think of anything else I'd rather do.
Well, you know, an awful lot of people have paved the way for so many of us to be able to talk about it, let alone play it. And here's something, Arnold, that you probably didn't even think of. I do. In terms of you, because you were set to do the show today, and in 2 days, it will be Ornette Coleman's 84th birthday.
Yes.
And
my hero, one of my heroes.
Well, see, I see a correlation between you and Ornette. He did something that caused a lot of people to spin their heads a la Linda Blair when he decided that he wasn't going to do what the current trend was to do in jazz. He wanted to do things his way, and Don Cherry heard that particular sound that Ornette had, and he bonded with that. He got it, but a lot of people didn't.
Yes.
He was free form.
Yes.
He was he didn't care. He wanted to play what he felt. So
he did not adhere to the rules, but he was still in the vein of a jazz musician.
Yes, and he was a pioneer. He created a different pathway. So when all is said and done, I mean, what are you going to be remembered for? The mediocrity in you knowing how to play like somebody else who was hot? Or are you going to make inroads and create a buzz?
Yes. Well, you know, it takes a certain amount of conviction and courage. You have to stick to your guns. You just have to stick to your guns, and you have to believe in yourself. You have to believe in what you're doing, and maybe say a couple of prayers and just hope it all works out.
Well, it's working out for you. It's working out for you, because you're always.
But let me tell you, it has been a long and arduous road, but it's been a great road to travel for sure.
How when you do your the teaching is one thing, but when you are out there playing, do folks come to clubs to see you, different venues, and are they expecting, because you've got a lot of fans, they're expecting Arnold Strickland music, or do you have people who come to the venue and do not know what happened to them? Because what you put forth is just so different than what they expected. Do you get a cross current of different kinds of folks or what?
Well, it depends. Really, it depends on the gig that I'm doing, you know, because, I've done some gigs, let's say, with Reuben Wilson, you know, the great, you know, Blue Note recording artist, Hammond B3 organ master.
Mm.
And, you know, people sort of know, you know, when they come, they're going to basically see me play some soul jazz. You know, if they see me play, like, in a trio with Mike Clark, you know, the great drummer, for instance, or you know, some of the great New York musicians, then, you know, they sort of know, okay, well, you know, Arnold's going to maybe be playing in his vein. But now if they see me come and play Strychnine, then, you know, it's, you know, usually they're pretty blown away, and they probably have to go, they're probably going to have to bring some earplugs because, you know, it's just... we're gonna turn it up and it's gonna be aggressive sometimes, and it's gonna be with love, and it's gonna be soft sometimes. So it's gonna be a little bit of a mixture of both.
What is it that you find yourself doing in a teaching capacity? Do you find as the years have gone on and you've become so comfortable, but I'm sure always continually challenged by, like, one-to-one studies or academic studies where you're on a staff, what do you feel that is most challenging to you and what excites you? You teach a wide array of different kinds of styles. Have you been thinking that you're really absorbed now in classical stylings to teach somebody, or are you rekindling a love for jazz, or is rock coming back to you these days and you're thinking, oh my God, I missed so much the first time around, I really love it now? What are you feeling?
Well, probably a little bit of all of that, but let me start by saying this. I do love to study the basics, because, you know, I think you as an artist, especially as a guitar player, you can really never get away from just studying the basics. You know, I was playing a C major scale with a student, you know, not too long ago, and I was like, wow, you know, there's really so much to learn in just a basic scale. You know, there's really a lot to learn. But for me, you know, I study the basics, but I also try to get into a lot of different sort of concepts that, you know, maybe most people might not know of, or, you know, might not apply to their particular way of playing music. So, you know, like recently I've been doing a lot of study of Messiaen, Oliver Messiaen, the great French composer.
Oh.
And he's such a wonderful genius player. And he has a book basically called The Limited. It's basically about the modes of limited transposition, and it's just such a, not to get into so much detail about the harmonic concept, but it's such a great, for any jazz musician, I think it would be a great study, just great study of just learning how to free yourself from, you know, the typical conventions of maybe, you know, as a jazz musician, you know, when you do learn the basic scales that you go to, let's say, Berkeley or any of these schools for, you know, you learn all these scales, and then you have to learn how to apply them. But you still have to learn the music, and you have to learn to speak the language of the music. But then after you do that, you keep learning and just keep absorbing. And, you know, I can always find inspiration from somewhere on this planet, for sure, to add to life.
Yes, you above most people, because you seem to be so in touch with everything around you as compared to a musician who is focused on the technique. You really do get involved with, and you use this word, the vibe of what is going on in your immediate surroundings. And that's everything.
Yes. And, you know, I think as a kid, I probably got a lot of that from Jimi Hendrix, just listening to his music and, you know, reading some of his, you know, his writings and understanding how he approached music. You know, he didn't know how to read, you know, he couldn't write music, but, you know, he heard music as colors, but still he was one of the greatest guitar players of all time. You know, so, I mean, for me as a kid, I used to have a Jimi Hendrix poster on my wall, and I just used to stare at it for hour after hour after hour while playing his music, and just, you know, try to fathom what was he feeling, what was he doing, what kind of what kind of creative force is guiding this great guitar player? And
I hear you in more ways than you might imagine, because we have been so candid today on the show, and this is further candid conversation. As a high school girl going to Bishop McDevitt High School between 1966 and 1970, for us, the girls who were involved in listening to music, and as you might suspect, during that time, what a wide array of different kinds of rock music were in our ears. And here comes Jimi Hendrix, and this was a mostly white high school. So to see a black rock and roller who had that depth and that kind of soul, who was able to speak to us not only in a musical way, but awakened us sexually. in ways that we had not experienced before him. I would sit and draw. I would draw him for hours.
Wow.
I would look at his picture, and I would draw him, and then I would touch the drawings. There was something deeply wrong with me, Arnold.
Well, that's why you're the host of Hybrid Jazz. You know, it all comes full circle.
Man, I hear you. He was like no one that had ever played before, and no one since.
Especially on the guitar. You know, as quiet as it's kept, maybe not as quiet as it's kept, but, you know, Jimi Hendrix really probably created heavy metal, rock and roll. You know, I mean, well, let's say Chuck Berry probably really created rock and roll, but Jimi Hendrix was definitely a great influence on millions and millions and millions of people, and millions of musicians as well, including myself.
For sure, and what people don't necessarily discuss is that, I know a couple of guys actually personally who were involved in the early stages of fusion, but if you want to get really technical, you go back to Jimi Hendrix, and you are seeing the underpinnings of what he had in mind in incorporating jazz into rock. And other people will take credit for it, but the truth of the matter is that he piqued Miles Davis's interest so much, and until they got into a fight about women, because that's what guys do a lot of the time, they were supposed to work together, but they never quite got it together. But Jimmy was responsible in a large degree for the birth of fusion. And that's it.
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely. Yes, him, Tony Williams, especially Tony Williams. I mean, that's another one of my heroes. And, you know, I would also definitely have to mention Coltrane. I mean, for me, John Coltrane was probably the closest sort of musician spiritually to...
Oh, yes.
I just say like a musical sort of spirituality to Jimi Hendrix. I mean, and I'm really greatly influenced by him as well. But and also Miles. I mean, Miles is, of course... You know, Miles is definitely one of my heroes. I mean, he's just a musical genius. And, you know, Miles is really the one who maybe he didn't start the jazz fusion. I mean, for me, there would probably be Tony Williams. But, you know, he definitely was a guy who was not afraid to do anything musically, whatever he heard, whatever he felt, whatever he wanted to do. You know, basically, he just did it. And did it with a lot of conviction as well.
He did, and it really does bear mentioning that when there is an artist like that who has such presence of mind to have the confidence in knowing that music must be played like this. This is the way I hear it. I can't go back to the old stuff that I used to do. I have to give you the new music that's in my head. Why would I want to go back to the old stuff? I want to give you some new music. He was like that. He was just had such a peace of mind about who he was And when an audience hears that, doesn't that mean everything? You're on stage and you're playing music for people who are hungry to hear what you have to say. If you were to do it in any other way that wasn't Arnold Strickland, you wouldn't be a truthful artist and people wouldn't get healed.
Exactly. And I'll tell you a story. When I used to be the house guitar player at the Blue Note Jazz Club here in New York, many years back.
Wow.
And yeah, and you know, I didn't get that gig because I sounded like Arnold Strickland like George Benson. I really got the gig because, you know, maybe I was a little bit unique. But, you know, it was hard for me to work in New York when I first got here because I don't even know if I should really say this, but most of the people that got the gigs, you know, they all really sounded like the greats on the guitar, you know, the George Bensons and the Wes Montgomerys, and that just wasn't me. And I remember one day at the Blue Note, I was playing, I took a solo, and then Victor Bailey, you know, the great bass player, came up to the stage. He said, "Man, whatever you do, keep doing what you're doing. I'm just so happy that you don't sound like George Benson like a lot of other guys." And that for me, it was really inspiring, and it was sort of affirmation for me in a sense, just to keep doing
keep doing it,
and so. You know, I have a lot of little stories like that where...
Oh, that means everything.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean...
Yeah, It really did.
People,
it really did.
They don't think about that. They make careers out of sounding like everybody else. And even when they know that they have some sort of gift, it's such a fearsome thing for them to consider that they do step out of the box. And it takes a certain kind of strength of character, or it takes a mentor to say, you know what, you don't have any choice. Why do you think that you were put here? So you could be a clone? No. It's,
exactly.
It's because
exactly.
You have something different to contribute to the universe. And that's why
yes.
I love you.
Thank you. I love you too, sweetheart. Yeah, and unfortunately, since I've been in New York, you know, I've really got a chance to play with a lot of those kind of musicians. I mean, my first gig here in New York, the first prominent jazz musician that I played with was the great Beaver Harris, and you know, he basically, you know, he heard me play, and he just immediately took me under his wing and let me. You know, open up gigs around New York in my name with him as the drummer. I mean, it was huge for me at the time. And, you know, his whole concept also, Beaver Harris, for those of you who don't know, Beaver Harris was a great, he probably has 70 records out, you know, but he's considered the father of avant-garde drums. But his whole concept was about what he called 360 degrees. You know, he believed that music just all came full circle. It was 360 degrees. It all came together. And, you know, and somehow you can just be, he was able to just understand that he could take the, you know, African music or jazz or rock or whatever it was for him and just make it all work, you know, through his voice. And I learned a lot from him. I really learned. He's another one of my mentors that I learned a lot from for sure.
See, and you did have mentors. You know, sometimes it's, and we were discussing this earlier too, the mentorship is so important because people need to be able to relax in their art. And when you have someone that takes you under their wing and encourages you, not only because of the kind nature of who they are, but because they believe in what you do as opposed
yes.
to what they can formulate of you. They understand your particular potential, not how you can
yes.
sound like somebody else they have in mind to make money from you.
Absolutely. You know, and I also learned that sort of another one of my great mentors, as I mentioned before, was Reuben Wilson. And, you know, and he is basically considered the godfather of acid jazz. You know, he's sort of the guy, you know, was at the forefront of acid jazz. And, you know, and he also was another guy, you know, when I first came to New York that also, you know, took me under his wing, made sure I had gigs in New York, you know. As a matter of fact, I went to sit in with him the first time I met him, and then I didn't go back for a couple of weeks, and then I went back and he said, what happened to you? You have to be here every week. You're on the gig. I was like, oh, really? So, you know, he took me under his wing. He was so kind to me, and, you know, he just basically, he's another one that really taught me a lot about music, about comping, about feel, about groove, and not to be afraid to be open to whatever it is that you felt and you were able to play.
That's so beautiful. Oh, my gosh. To have that kind, to feel that kind of freedom in knowing that your path is going to be okay because you have people who have given you the green light. It's not that you have to seek permission from anybody, but when you have an environment that fosters that nurturing,
yes.
Man, you
yes.
feel like you can do
yes.
anything. God.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, they saw it in me. I was just, you know, just so hungry and I just wanted to play so much. And, you know, I just, you know, and when I, every time I come to the bandstand, you know, I was aggressive and, you know, and they're like, you know, what are you playing? I'm like, well, you know, as a matter of fact, I remember once playing at the Blue Note and some guys came up to me and they said, do you know what you're playing? What are you playing? And I was like, I don't know. You know, I'm just playing me, you know. But I got a lot of praise at the Blue Note, you know, and I really did. And that was another place where, you know, it definitely sort of, you know, it definitely helped me to grow as a musician, you know, being able to, you know, see, you know, especially at that time, you know, being able to, like, you know, open up for Herbie and or Chick, you know, or John Scofield or, you know, any of the greats, and then being able to hang out with them after the gig, and then they come up and they sit in with you, and it was definitely a great experience.
See, you've just said a lot here in that first part of the, that passage that you've just quoted about the life of Arnold Strickland. There are still so many jazz snobs who will say, well, you really can't do it that way because the greats didn't do it that way, or people who chafe at the notion that the Great American Songbook, for example, somebody's playing with a lyric, somebody's playing with that note, it shouldn't be done that way. Oh, my God, people can drive you insane. So the best thought process involved in that is that, and you just said it again, if you have people that really want to be playing with you, you've mentioned Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea, you don't have to make any apology at all anymore to any of those folks who take you to task for not playing in the traditional and/or bebop way or whatever way they have in mind. I don't know where it comes from that people feel so contained that they must hear jazz the same way all the time. What is it, Arnold?
And not only that, yes, that's so true. And not only that, they want to hear you sound like the last great guy, or, you know, they don't think it's valid. And I don't think that that's the real spirit of jazz. I mean, I don't think that, you know, Charlie Parker went in thinking like that, or like you said, Ornette Coleman, you know, some of those, or even Miles, of course, Miles. But, you know, I don't know. I just think that maybe somewhere along the line, maybe, you know, because guys maybe couldn't get a lot of work, or maybe, you know, you needed to work because you needed to sound like the last great guy, then maybe that started to let all these musicians say, well, okay, well, you know, I got to sound like this, I got to practice like this, I got to sound like this, I got to sound like that guy. But, I mean, for me, it just never rang true.
And you know, Arnold, because you've done the research, when these cats first started out, they weren't thinking about, hey, you know what, I got to keep it straight ahead, I got to toe the line, buddy. I mean, John Coltrane drove some people out of their minds. McCoy Tyner went screaming into the streets because it wasn't the same.
Absolutely.
Philly. You know, here are a couple of Philly guys, and McCoy didn't understand this new path that John was taking. So,
well, believe it or not, neither did Miles. Neither did Miles. Yeah. I mean, Miles used to fire train every week and hire him back the next day.
And you know what kills me? Here's Miles. He goes out in the summer and he picks up a soprano sax for Coltrane. And you know what? Coltrane became so immersed in that soprano sax, and then he left Miles.
Yes. Yes.
Oh my God. Oh, that kills me. And you know, other people come along like Pharoah Sanders. Pharoah Sanders got John Coltrane. So for every time somebody steps out of line, some people may get their knickers chafed, but then other people come, they step up to the plate and they go, oh, this is the kind of stuff I can relate to.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if you've heard this very famous interview with Coltrane. I think he might have been in France somewhere. But, the interviewer started off asking Coltrane, you know, why is he so angry with his music? And, you know, why is he getting such bad reviews? And what is he trying to prove? And why does he play that way? And Coltrane just basically told him, well, I just have some devices that I'm just trying to work through. I mean, he was so humble with his answer. But you can definitely tell that there was a point in Train's life where people just didn't understand, you know, the sort of music that he was trying to convey to the planet.
Well, and he's so fascinating. I mean, I know that originally he's from North Carolina, but we claim him in Philadelphia. We claim him because he spent so much time in Philly. And Carl Grubbs has been a guest on the show, and Carl's cousin was Naima. So, Carl. Yes. So Carl spent a lot of time with John being in his house, and Carl said that he would just go in the back room and play for hours and hours.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow.
No doubt about it. I definitely believe that.
He was already into that spiritual zone, but see, for a guy like that, who, beautiful, handsome guy, And all these other cats, gosh, this could be a whole other show, honest to goodness, Arnold. I mean, for an African-American jazz man around this time, so many were leaving the United States because of the segregation factor, and they couldn't take it because they would sell out the venues.
Dexter Gordon.
Yes. And then you couldn't stay at the hotels where you just sold out the club.
Absolutely. You had to walk in the back door of the Cotton Club, for instance.
Oh, my God. Isn't that crazy? So crazy.
That's so crazy.
Here's Coltrane, who's, a lot of women on the road, a lot of drugs being offered, a lot of drinking involved, and he is trying to find the spiritual plateau.
Exactly. You know, and the funny thing, you know, you speak of Philly. Did you know that Coltrane studied with a guitar player?
Yes. Yes. I don't know his name
Dennis
off the
Sandoli.
Top of my head. Oh, that's the
Dennis
name.
Sandoli.
Sandoli. Sandoli, yes.
Sandoli. 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 And supposedly, he's the one that hipped Coltrane to the thesaurus of scales and melodic patterns by the great writer Nicholas Slonimsky, which in turn Coltrane developed his whole concept of giant steps with the whole three-tonic system.
It's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And then there was that large influence of Sidney Bechet, who I absolutely love. And you can
A giant.
Giant
steps. And they love him in New Orleans, too.
Oh, I'm sure. And look, I'm looking at the time. How did I know this was going to happen? All right, let me play something for folks. I want to play the sample that you gave me. I want to give them the skydive sample, if that's okay, first.
Sure, absolutely.
Yes. So and tell us ahead of time, too. I want folks to be able to buy your music or find out more about you. Could you give me a definitive source for that?
Yes. Well, you know, they can always come to arnoldstrickland.com or okay. they can check me out on my Facebook artist page, which is backslash Strick9, which is STRICK9. They can go to my Reverb Nation page, which is also Strick9 or Arnold Strickland as well.
And you also have a Twitter account too, because we just followed each other.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
If I was a person who was listening, I would be able to purchase Skydive, for example. Would I be able to?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
Good. All right. I want folks to pay attention to my guest today. I've been waiting for a little bit. We've been trying to figure out a date. This is Arnold Strickland, and this is called Skydive on Hybrid Jazz. Now, see, Arnold Strickland is with us today on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy, and I love that kind of vibe so much, because not only does it catapult me back into the late 60s, early 70s, and a combination of the different bands that I loved so much, including, by the way, the Allman Brothers Band, when Duane and Barry were still alive. Thank you, Lord. Woo! But also... It just propels me into the future as well. So I just really enjoy immersing myself in that kind of lush array of sounds. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. Arnold, thank you.
Thank you. It definitely was a sonic adventure for sure.
Oh, well, you know, this is a question I wasn't going to ask you. What do you find yourself in your off time? Do you continually play music that you create, or do you listen to people? Are you getting a real strong feel about listening to anybody in particular? Do you get inspired by anybody these days as opposed to who you used to get inspired by?
Well, I do. I mean, I try to listen to a little bit of everybody, you know, just to check out what other guys are doing. But, you know, I mean, I think, like I said before, right now I'm really sort of into this whole sort of Oliver Messiaen thing. It's just really really grabbed a hold of me, and I'm studying those concepts and trying to apply a little bit of that to what I do as far as compositionally, and it's just a way of just freeing, just another way of being free.
I love that. Well, you know, we mentioned this earlier when we had a couple of educators, and we all had performers. Female performers on the show. I made mention of this.
I heard that.
I love that you do the Skype lessons to students in Japan. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I think I was probably one of the first guys to do that. I mean, at least from what I saw. And it just so happened that I used to teach at this place called the Music Building here in New York. And it's basically just a huge building of rehearsal studios. And I knew this Japanese guy, and he asked me if I could give him some lessons, and I went there. And then I just started to teach, you know, I started to teach all these Japanese people basically, you know, sort of guitar and almost really whatever they wanted to learn musically. But most of it was guitar arranging, you know, some sort of, you know, songwriting and you know, jazz theory. And then basically they all had to go back to Japan because of some sort of immigration problem. And then it was about 6 or 7 years later that one of them found me on Facebook. And he's like, oh, I really wanted to find you. I really wanted to study with you. And, you know, I just said, So, you know, we just came up with this whole Skype idea. And it basically just took off from there. And I couldn't believe how the technology has allowed you to do so much stuff in real time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I set up a PayPal account. So, you know, they pay me in advance and, you know, they put a little bit of money into the PayPal account and I give them some lessons. And, you know, if they want to continue, they put some more money into the PayPal account and then we do another month. And that's basically how I got started. But it's a really great way of teaching, you know, and you know, getting your getting to help people out, you know, from who are 5,000-6,000 miles away.
Oh, and look, not only is it an experience that is a fresh experience musically, but what you're doing culturally to bridge that gap, because they're learning about different kinds of Americans through this, and you're fostering your own kind of peace. Did you ever think about it that way?
I haven't, but you know, I think I will, because it's a pretty interesting way of phrasing it, for sure. Absolutely.
Oh yeah. Definitely. This is exactly the kind of momentum that we need, especially in music circles. I mean, how wonderful is that to consider that people of different sorts of cultures can communicate musically and you get to learn about somebody else's music, and people in the States in jazz really need to know other interpretations of jazz in the world and other kinds of music in order to be inspired to create more of what they do. It's a win-win situation. Yeah, I love
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's really a great idea. I think more and more musicians are starting to catch on to the idea. I mean, I haven't seen a lot of people doing it, but I think slowly the whole Skype thing with the, you know, giving lessons is starting to take off a little bit, for sure.
Oh, yeah, and people hadn't maybe considered the possibilities of why it could be so good, but anything that we can do to promote peace Woo! So you're doing your share,
yes,
kiddo.
And the love of music. And,
yes!
Thank you. And the love of music.
The love of
and,
music.
And, you know, and
the
thing about, you know, teaching, and the thing about teaching music also, especially, you know, any sort of, especially with the guitar, and you can, you know, you don't really have to, you know, a couple of the guys that I teach, they don't really speak English that well, but, you know, they certainly can understand, you know, when they watch my hands, and I can see their hands, and I can say, you put this hand on this string, and you can do that, and, you know, look at your thumb, maybe your thumb's not correct, or, you know, you have to focus on your tone, and so it's really great. Fantastic.
And if they keep coming back, then that means you're a good teacher. So
absolutely.
Well, listen, I have 10 minutes. I want to get to another song, and I promised people I would play Invasion of the Booty Snatchers. I promise.
Yes.
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 Please let me play this song. Oh, I just
and let
love
me say
this.
That on – let me just say that this band, this Strict Nine band, is with two of the greatest jazz musicians that are living right now, to me. You know, that's Nasheed Waits on drums, who is just a monster. I couldn't play with a better drummer, really. And another guy by the name of Greg Organ Monk Lewis. And, you know, we've worked out this Strict Nine concept for years and years and years in Nasheed Waits' studio, and you know, this is sort of the culmination of some of the stuff we've been working on.
Well, it's just so hot. This is Arnold Drickland on the show today on Hybrid Jazz, and you'll be able to purchase this if you like. So hang on to your hats. We're going to have a sweet ride here on Hybrid Jazz. We'll be right back. the sweetest kind of infused controlled chaos that I ever heard. I love that. Where am I? Man, it is so awesome.
Say that again.
Oh, my God. I knew this was going to be
goodness.
A trip. Man, you know what?
The Sonic Adventures.
Seriously. And you need to have your own blog or your comic strip. You need to have an Arnold Strickland comic strip. That would be so cool. I mean, you with your little glasses on and, you know, making sure you make your way throughout the world and your adventures on vibing every day, it would be a hit.
You know, it's funny you said that because, you know, somebody actually said that to Greg. Actually, Greg Lewis presented that to me a few years back. He's like, we should do a comic strip.
Really?
I thought
it was
crazy,
geez.
But I...
No. Listen, you are a... As Sammy Davis Jr. used to say, oh, my God, one of my favorite expressions of all time, you're a different breed of cat. Oh, my gosh.
Blame it on my mom. I don't know. Blame it on mom or dad or somebody. I don't know.
No, it's wonderful. It's terribly refreshing. Oh, my gosh. I just can't say enough, Arnold. Thank you so much. The hour has
Thank
flown
by. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you.
It certainly has. I appreciate you as well. Thank you so much for this wonderful interview. You're the best. You're just keeping jazz alive, and we need more people like you for sure. Absolutely.
Aww.
I just want to give you a round of applause.
Bless your heart. I love your voice so much, and I anytime you want to drop by again, anytime there's something new, you know, folks can go to arnoldstrickland.com. I was just there. But you just know that you have a standing invitation all the time, Arnold.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. We're going to be releasing some new music this year, so I'll definitely be in touch.
That would be great. Thank you very much. And we'll communicate via Twitter or Facebook.
Absolutely. I look forward to it.
All right, Arnold. Thanks.
Okay, thank you too, Trish.
All right,
Ciao.
Talk to you soon. Ciao.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
We've got less than 60 seconds to tell you that on Tuesday it will be Dante Winslow from the Winslow Dynasty touring with Justin Timberlake, but he's home for his own CD release party that's going to be taking place in Baltimore at Mugubi's. Get ready. He's going to be at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum tomorrow, too. Thank you to all of my guests today. Thanks to the chat roomers, Beach and Todd. I see you there. God bless. And we'll talk to you soon. Have a wonderful weekend. Be safe. And thanks for listening to Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.